Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCain. As part of our treasure hunt for solutions, today we're talking about creating a world that works for 100% of humanity in the shortest possible time without ecological offense or the disadvantage of anyone. This challenge was first issued by pioneer Buckminster Fuller and has taken on new urgency as we grapple with climate change, species extinction, growing use of toxins, and widening gaps between rich and poor in the U.S. and around the world. Creating a world that works for everyone will require reinventing our economy in this generation. Here to talk with us about how we meet this challenge is Gil Friend, a good friend of mine. Gil is one of the founders of the Sustainable Business Movement and was named an inaugural member of the Sustainability Hall of Fame. The Guardian calls him one of the 10 most influential sustainability voices in America. For more than 20 years, Gil helped companies design, implement, and measure profitable sustainability strategies. He has advised a long list of impressive clients, including giants like Coca-Cola, eBay, Hewlett-Packard, Levi Strauss, Nike, and Raytheon. Before becoming a business consultant, Gil Friend served in the California Governor's Office, developing early sustainability policies and programs that helped make California a world leader in sustainability. He was co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, a leading urban ecology and economic development think and do tank. He most recently served as the Chief Sustainability Officer for the City of Palo Alto, California, which challenged him to make Palo Alto the greenest city in America. He is a pragmatic visionary with broad and deep experience in both business and government that gives him a unique perspective on how we can reinvent our economy in one generation. Gil Friend, welcome back to All Together Now.
Thanks, Eleanor. I'm delighted to be here with you.
Yeah, I'm so happy to have you back. It was actually just 5 years ago this week that you were on the show, and you were just beginning your work as Chief Sustainability Officer for Palo Alto. So I'm eager to learn what happened. So let's talk about that first, and then we can broaden the conversation into the sustainability revolution more broadly. Does that make sense?
Sounds good to me.
Great. So let's start at the beginning. You had been advising some of the world's leading companies and then decided to go to work for Palo Alto as the Chief Sustainability Officer. Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, there was a step in the decision before that, Eleanor. I decided first that after actually 30 years, not 20 years, of advising companies and mm-hmm. You know, from a business model perspective, renting my brain by the hour selling advice that maybe gets adopted and maybe doesn't get adopted. Mm-hmm. And I thought it'd be a good time to go inside an organization, to be hands on the wheel and butt on the line, to be responsible for making the changes happen, not just suggesting what should happen. I thought, given where I had been working, that I would find a chief sustainability officer position in a progressive corporation. But Palo Alto came knocking on the door through their headhunter. My first response was, why would I want to go work for a city when I could work for a major international company? And the city manager, Jim Keen, said, come on down and check us out. Take a look for yourself and then decide. So I did, and what I saw there was a remarkable platform. A city that is obviously very wealthy and highly educated and progressive, we know that, but it also had a decades-long commitment to environmental quality and sustainability, had made a number of innovative moves over that time, including one of the first climate action plans in the United States in 2005, owned a full-service municipal utility, the only full-service muni in California, which gave it a unique perspective and economic ability to make bold moves. And so I thought, this is good. This is a place where I can stand and try to put into action some of the things that I've been thinking about and seeing that my colleagues around the world have been implementing in various other places, try to bring that all together in one place and use the brand of Palo Alto, which is an internationally recognized brand, as a way to not only do good things on the ground that benefit the citizens of that community, but do it in a way that can be an example that can be emulated and adopted and copied around the world.
Fantastic. So what happened? What were your goals when you started out? And how did it work out?
Well, it worked out, I would have to say, impressively great. I think we've done a lot. My goals were the request from the city manager was to take a city that had already done a lot of good stuff, but piecemeal, and weave mm-hmm. that together into a strategy. Mm-hmm. With a point of the spear that could really organize and energize all the good work that had already been going on. CSO position is a funny one. It's a position generally without power and without much budget. It's really an influence position, mm-hmm. building relationships, inspiring people, helping them see opportunities and find pathways past the blockages that stop them. And so, everything that I'm saying, I'll speak in the first person, but it's really representing the work of dozens of people who work with me across the city organization over the past 5 years. So the first thing was to, was to do a lot of listening.
Mm-hmm.
Hear what people were up to, hear what people's aspirations were. Both among the city employees and the citizenry. One of the first things we did with the city employees was build a catalog of what's in motion, because nobody had a view of all the sustainability initiatives, and we found about 154 of them.
Wow.
And just putting that in front of people, saying this is what you already got going on, was itself a big uplift in energy. And then the next discussion, of course, was as we start thinking about climate, where do we want to plant our flag? California had already set a goal of reducing emissions 80% from the 1990 levels, reducing them 80% by 2050. That's the target that that the UN and the IPCC had set, but California way ahead of the United States in that regard. And so one of the questions we asked was, do we set that goal for the city? Do we set a bolder but still kind of understandable goal of shooting for the 80% target by 2030, 20 years ahead of the California target, which, for reasons I can explain, seemed within reach. But I also laid on the table the notion of a moonshot. Could we consider getting to 100% carbon neutral by 2025? Which shocked some people. In fact, one of my colleagues, director of one of the city departments, said, but Gil, how could we set a goal if we don't know exactly how we're going to reach it? And that's when I knew that I was on a different planet, because the planet that I live on, a goal that don't know how to reach is a fascinating opportunity. It's an opportunity to discover and learn and innovate. And for this person, it was terrifying, because what if we fail?
Well, and your analogy there on the moonshot is exactly right, because when President Kennedy said we're going to land a man on the moon within a decade, people didn't know exactly really how we were going to do that, but it was such an inspirational challenge. Everybody rose to it and made it happen.
Yeah, and it went with some very specific actions. NASA, in fact, didn't know how to do it, but one of the things they did, they did two remarkable moves right at the beginning. They had a victory party. They celebrated the successful moon mission. That was day one of the project, was the celebration. Day two, they said, let's step back a moment and ask, how did we do that? What did we do in this imaginary exercise? What did we do in year 10 that enabled this mission to happen? What did we do in year 9 that enabled year 10 to happen? And they stepped themselves backwards and actually reverse engineered this impossible mission. And it's a great move because, when you look at an impossible goal, it's really easy for people to get frozen into inaction. Where do I start? What's the right first step to do? How is it going to work? I don't know where it's going to go. But this imaginary exercise of projecting yourself into a successful future and then working backwards opens up new possibilities that people couldn't see. Now, there's still engineering to do. There's still lots of specific technical nuts and bolts to do, but it set a creative discovery frame around the whole project. And if you'll allow me one more NASA story, The story is told that again and again throughout the Apollo mission, they came upon impossible technical requirements. You know, how do we develop thermal cladding for the capsule that will insulate the astronauts from 25,000 degree Fahrenheit reentry temperatures and keep that thermal cladding adhered to the capsule? We don't know how to do that. So you had two options at that point. You could go to the President of the United States and say, sir, you have to go on international television and cancel the mission because we can't do it. Not a very attractive option. Or what they did was they would take the problem and turn it into a detailed design specification. Material has to be of a certain density. It has to have certain temperature insulating capabilities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they would take that down the hall to a division called the Department of It Can't Be Done.
Was that really the name of the division?
Well, that was the name of the division. That's what I'm told by one of the NASA HR people.
We have one of those in politics, by the way. We call it the U.S. Congress.
Well, this is a different kind, because in this case, they would say to the Department of It Can't Be Done, here's the specification, please invent this thing.
Wow.
And sometimes 2 days later and sometimes 6 months later, the Department of It Can't Be Done would come back down the hall and say, here's this thing that you asked for. We have now invented this thing that didn't exist before that was necessary for this mission. They did that 3,000 times.
Wow.
In the course of the Apollo mission. So, as you might imagine, that orients me very differently to the notion of possibility and impossibility, perhaps, than most people.
Absolutely.
Some people, like my colleague at the city, shut down. It's impossible. Yep. I'm afraid of failure. Let's not do it. And some of us say, wow, what a great challenge. How interesting. What could be more fascinating than figuring out something that's never been done to solve a problem that has seemed insoluble? And in the case of my corporate clients, to do it in a way that is profitable and brand building.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. So did you in fact set that goal? What goal did you end up with? I mean, you obviously didn't have everybody on board. You had the realists kind of gasping for air and saying, I don't want to set us up for failure. And then you had other adventurers like yourself who said, hey, let's go for it.
Well, it turned out to be the Goldilocks and the Three Bears story. We chose 80% by 2030, which was bold and world-leading. And, you know, with some stretching and some good work within reach. And the council, bless their hearts, adopted that unanimously.
Wow.
For the city. And that became the pivot of the Sustainability and Climate Action Plan that they also adopted unanimously, that set in motion a series of activities ranging from energy, buildings, transportation, water, city operations, natural environment, economic development and finance, and a bunch of other issues where the detailed strategies of how do you implement that got laid out. And now there are four teams of about 30 people from 12 departments around the city working on the first 3 years of implementation of that plan.
Wow, that's impressive.
The important thing there, Eleanor, is that it's a combination of both the big speculative, you know, for some people hard to imagine vision, but also the real nuts and bolts specific particulars of how do you make it work within a city bureaucracy? How do you pay for it? How do you stage the resources? How do you develop the training and orientation of the people? Because the vision doesn't get you there. Vision's necessary, but the folks who will, you know, drive the trucks and turn the wrenches and file the documents and make it work on the ground is equally necessary. So the city is now in that next phase of working to embed these ideas into the day-to-day operations of how the city runs.
So do you think Palo Alto is going to hit the goal of 80% emissions reduction by 2030?
I expect that they will. The 2018 numbers aren't in yet, but our estimates are that that Palo Alto will leave 2018 at about 54%.
Wow! So you're well on your way.
Well on our way. With some of the pieces well within reach, and the big challenge that remains for Palo Alto and for a lot of cities is transportation. Last time we ran the numbers, about three-quarters of our greenhouse gas emissions came from transportation, largely from commuting. Mm-hmm. And if you're familiar with the Bay Area, you know that there's an enormous commute shed. People are, because the housing prices are so high, people often have to live in the periphery and drive into work. Some people commuting, 30 minutes, some commuting 2 hours. And so that's where the lion's share of the remaining emissions are for Palo Alto. And, of course, that's a problem that it doesn't control.
Right, and there are some things you hit like that. That's more kind of a statewide or national thing, is like how much public transportation can we put in so people can not have to jump in their car every time they're going somewhere, but you can hop on a high-speed rail or a bus or something, a shuttle, something that's more of a public transit.
High-speed rail or bus or shuttle or trains or shared vehicles like Lyft and Uber, or e-bikes and scooters and bikes, and not to forget walkability. So this comes to questions of how do you design a city? Where do you put things? Where do you, California has a history of putting its business centers near freeways, not near rail lines, which means that people who commute by rail have a hard time getting that last mile to work. So urban planning becomes part of the mix, too. All of that is there. You need to think about all of that, and I would say not necessarily state level and regional level, but for here, it's or national level, you said. Here it's regional level. The San Francisco Bay Area is, 7 or 8 million people, 9 counties, 105 or 110 cities. It's its own economic nexus. That's a region that can, in theory, address this problem. The challenge is you got nine counties, 105 cities, and 20 different transit operators and 20 other agencies that regulate transit. So finding the locus of how we get a regional solution is really challenging. The one thing I do know is this, and we put this out as kind of the central design brief for all of our transportation thinking, is to ask one question: how do we make it more convenient for anybody, anywhere, at any time, to not have to get into a car and drive? And if you keep asking that question, then a different set of design decisions unfold. A lot of environmentalists take a punitive approach to problems like transportation and others. Let's make it harder for people to drive. Let's make it more costly for people to drive. And that might be part of the mix. But I think the key is, how do you make it more easy for people not to drive?
Have you figured out the answer?
Well, the answer, it's not going to fit in a radio show of this length, but the answer is going to be, first of all, remove the subsidies to the private automobile.
Right.
City of Palo Alto provides free parking. Well, if you have free parking and the train costs you money, what are you going to do? But, of course, that free parking represents it costs $70,000 to build a parking space. The city's about to spend $100 million on 2 new parking garages. In a world where private vehicle driving and parking is going to decline, we're already seeing it decline. We're already seeing car purchasing among young Americans go down. You got to think about what problem you're trying to solve. We yield an enormous percentage of the land area of our cities to pavement and parking lots and automobiles, parking structures and so forth. That's land that could go into other uses. That's land that could in fact be green space that captured water and starts to solve another problem at the same time. So the baseline problem is to get our brains around the economics in a way that's right, is to remove the perverse subsidies and invest in the future that we want and not in the future that we don't want. Second is to support and encourage multiple modes of transportation that don't require parking. Transit is a part of the mix, but it's not the only part of it. But even in the transit part, you've got to focus on good service. Thin coverage of transit routes and 15 and 30 minute waiting times isn't going to do it. You have to have tight coverage. You have to have waiting times under 7 minutes. I was in Vienna this spring, and you didn't need a schedule to get around because you'd walk onto a train platform and every 3 minutes there's a train going to where you want to go. There's a sufficiency of service that makes it convenient and easy for people. And that's a very different model than the typical U.S. transit model where ridership goes down and we cut the routes, and therefore ridership goes down and we cut the routes. This has to be service-focused, customer-focused, like any other business, and look at how do we really understand people's needs and serve them. And that's a frame that you can use not just with transportation, but with built environment, economic strategies, and all the rest. What is it that people need? How do we deliver it to them in a way that works economically and ecologically?
And, of course, we've had kind of the opposite for 100 years, where the design has been the expectation more and more people would be buying cars and driving cars, so we build more roads, we build more bridges and more parking lots and more garages, and that whole mindset has just got to shift.
Well, and it's going to shift. It has to shift. And remember, the mindset didn't just come about at random. It came about, obviously, there was the technological marvel of this amazing dense energy source called petroleum. There was the innovations in the automobile, but also in the late 1940s in the city of Los Angeles. And if you don't want to take my word for it, go see who framed Roger Rabbit. In the late 1940s, General Motors and Esso, the oil company that's now ExxonMobil, and Firestone, the tire company, jointly came together to buy and shut down the mass transit systems of Los Angeles.
Right,
so that
exactly.
They could sell more cars, petroleum, and tires. That was then. In the time since then, we have an economy that's built on highly subsidized petroleum, and it's remarkable. You know, we talk about capitalism and the free market, but we are subsidizing fossil fuels globally to the tune of an estimated $800 billion a year. Rocky Mountain Institute estimates that if you monetize the cost of the environmental externalities that go into bringing a gallon of gasoline to the pump, you wouldn't be paying $3 a gallon. You'd be paying $15 to $20 a gallon. And the question I ask is that if you were paying $15 a gallon for gasoline, would you be driving the car you're driving today? Everybody says, of course not. The question behind that is, would anybody be making the car you're driving today? And the answer is pretty much, of course not. And that's why we're seeing the accelerating penetration of electric vehicles into the marketplace worldwide.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating.
So things are changing. Things are changing.
Yeah,
and part of the key is to kill the subsidies for the future that we don't want and get the prices right so that the market gives us the signals to guide consumer behavior toward choices that make more sense.
Mm-hmm. Right, and it's fascinating to me you're working at the city level. Now, obviously, some of this is being done at a national level that you had no control over, the subsidies for what we don't want. Mm-hmm. But talk a little bit, like, what do you feel of this incredible experience you had and the bold thinking you brought in? First of all, you glad that you chose the Goldilocks, kind of the dish kind of warm but not too hot or not too cold? Or do you
completely
wish you had kind of been able to go for the gold?
Well, the gold would have been more fun. But,
yes.
You know, but you can only lead where people are ready to go.
Right.
And that's where people were ready to go, and I figured let's get started there, and then as we start to book successes against that goal, there may come a point in a year or 2 years or 5 years where people say, you know, we could really ratchet this up. Let's get more aggressive. Now, based on their own learning and their own experiences, not based on some guy coming in and saying, hey, here's what we should do, because that's not how democracy works.
Right. And, it's not how anything works. You know, if the key is to shift a direction and get going and take some of those steps, and then you go, oh, I did that, now I can do this. So you can show what's possible to people who are the doubters.
Exactly. And there's nothing that shows possibility like a successful example on the ground that you can see and taste and touch and walk in or drive in or look at the economics of and say, yeah, that really worked. That wasn't just a crazy idea. It really worked.
Yeah. Nothing succeeds like success. And you, one of the hallmarks of your whole career has been the understanding of not only the big vision and the plan to get there, but also the monitoring and the measuring along the way.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of metrics did you use for the city of Palo Alto that showed people some of the successful examples as you moved forward with this move to cut emissions?
Well, the central one was the greenhouse gas emissions and watching them, you know, steadily come down through a series of moves that the city and community made. Another is the penetration of green buildings. Palo Alto has developed what we think is probably the most aggressive or one of the most aggressive green building codes in the country. And so, you know, looking at how that's propagating, how that's coming into action, and looking at the economics of that. We're required by state law to demonstrate the economic viability of the measures that we propose, and we did that. We look at things like water conservation. California, as you know, is periodically goes through droughts that people think are cyclical droughts that I think are actually part of a long-term trend of climate shift. But we have targets that are assigned to us by the state, and Palo Alto has each year not only met but exceeded those. I mean, it's, you know, citizens pulling together to say, we can do this, you know, and we can live well, even under a regime of reduced water use. We look at the transportation stats and see that Palo Alto has the busiest station in the entire Caltrain system, the regional rail system. And so, you know, you show there are a number of data points that you can watch and see trends that both underscore the progress and also highlight the places where we need to focus next.
Great. And of all the amazing things you did in Palo Alto, what are you most excited about having done in your time there as Chief Sustainability Officer?
Well, I think the central thing is developing with a lot of input from a lot of people, hundreds of people around the city, developing a climate action plan that we can be proud of, that is achievable, that has stretch goals in it, that touches on many aspects of community and local government life that will have beneficial side effects. You know, to get that built and in motion and adopted unanimously from a sometimes fickle city council and a sometimes skeptical citizenry is a big deal. So I'm very proud of that. I'm proud of the work that my colleagues have done to make it possible and that are, you know, carrying forth now in implementation. You know, the couple of things that I regret or I'm sorry that we weren't able to do one is that it was very challenging to get a forthright discussion about parking and automobile subsidies.
Nobody wants to give up their parking spot.
Well, nobody wanted to even talk about it. So that was challenging. And the other, which is, I think, it was my own personal regret, is that it wasn't until the last 6 months of my tenure that we tried to do something that we probably should have done sooner, which is to when staff brings proposals to the city council, it uses a template called called the city manager report. It has a particular structure of a summary and background and details and recommendations. And we proposed adding to that one question, one short paragraph of what is the potential sustainability impact of this action. Knowing that in some cases people would say none, and in some cases people would say, I don't know, and in some cases they'd say what it is. But the idea is to have that question just on the table every time the council considers anything. I think that will happen. I know some other cities have done that. We started too late. I started too late on that one. And that's one that I wish I had gotten into place sooner, because I think there's a lot of leverage in some very small steps like that one. They don't have to be big and dramatic and require big investment. Some of them are just, you know, a tweak on a form.
Right. But that tweak just has enormous ripple effects with every action that's taken.
Because it says it requires everybody, both staff members and council members, to just ask the question, of, you know, what is the impact of this? And if the answer is I don't know, then the next step might be, well, maybe I need to find out. Maybe this is something we need to research and learn more about. So it's a very small move with a lot of leverage.
Yeah. Well, you've created a great model there in Palo Alto with this ambitious yet achievable plan and getting lots in motion and cutting back on the carbon emissions, getting buy-in by some bureaucrats who I'm sure were had sparks flying with their heels dragging behind them, but you got people all moving in the same direction with great results. So why are you leaving?
Mission accomplished. I was asked to come and weave the existing initiatives of that community into a coherent strategy.
Mm-hmm.
I was asked to help raise the bar and put Palo Alto into the leadership of urban climate action around the country, around the world, and a few other things. And I think we did that. We did that well. So that's part of the answer, Eleanor. And the other part of the answer is that it was time for me to move on and, frankly, to get back into private sector, where most of my work had been.
Right.
To work with leading corporations, to work with the economic framework and policy framework that that guides and governs how we act as economic beings on this planet.
Well, and there's something refreshing about working with companies where if the CEO wants to do something, that's what's going to happen, whereas when you're working in the public sector,
it turns out it's not that cut and dried. The private sector has a different risk and reward matrix than the public sector does, but it's still a bureaucracy.
Yeah,
it's still a collection, not just of people, but a collection of parts of people who have to work things out together and find ways to come to agreement. And frankly, companies where the CEO says, do this because I said so, aren't going to be as successful as companies where the CEO says, I've got a vision, let's talk about it, let's figure it out together, let's make it happen together.
Right.
So I think the challenge, whether you are in a large corporation, a small family-held company, a city government, or a family, is how do we find a common vision? How do we find a common purpose and a common vision that expresses that purpose and a shared strategy that we can all agree with to build that and make that go? So in some ways, the game isn't all that different. I think one of the salient differences in the business world is that the success metrics are very clear and the list is very short. For city government, there's 100 different things you're paying attention to. If you're a public corporation, you need to deliver return to shareholders.
Mm-hmm.
And for some, that's all you need to do. We can talk about the defects of that approach, but it provides a real organizing clarity that is harder to come by in public sector.
Right.
Second, of course, is that that old line from Willie Sutton about why did you rob banks? He said that's where the money is.
Right, carbon emissions are.
It's where the carbon emissions are, but it's also where the financial resources are to be able to invest in new ways of doing what we do to build the world that we want to build.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I have a growing interest in more and more of my work over the coming years is going to be in the realm of finance, about how do we finance the future that we want.
Good. I want to talk about that a little more, but before we leave Palo Alto, I'm wondering, the initial challenge to you when you were recruited to become the Chief Sustainability Officer in Palo Alto was to make it the greenest city in America. Is Palo Alto now the greenest city in America?
Well, whenever we said that from year one, we said it with a smile on our face, because that's it's a kind of strange thing to say. There is no measure that determines that.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, it's multi-factor, and Palo Alto is good at some things, and New York is better at other things, and St. Louis is better at other things, and so really this is kind of a collaborative competition model. Everybody's trying to be the best, but all of us learn from each other. One of the first things I did was have us join an organization called the Urban Sustainability Directors Network, which is a coalition of now, I think, 220 cities in North America who have chief sustainability officers or something like that. Who have built a remarkable shared learning network where each of us is trying to be the best, but all of us are opening up our game book to everybody else and learning from each other.
All right. And speaking of learning from each other, given your incredible experience and expertise now in Palo Alto, helping to make it a green city, have you thought about being an advisor to other cities? Obviously, you can't go deep and spend 5 years with the work you did in Palo Alto, but to advise other cities on how they could, be further along on the sustainability path?
Mm-hmm. Very, very much so. And for that reason, my company, Natural Logic, which has traditionally focused on strategy consulting to corporations, is opening up a division that will be focused on working with cities, as well as another division that will be focused on finance. So that's some of the news to come, in the first quarter of this year.
Fantastic. And you're going to oversee all of this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you're going back to your company, Natural Logic?
Mm-hmm.
And advising...
Which people can find at natlogic.com. Yeah.
natlogic.com.
Yes.
Fantastic. So you're kind of revitalizing and coming into companies, but now focusing on finance. Why finance?
Because that's where the game is. That's where we set in motion the resources and commitments of how the world unfolds.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we choose to invest in fossil energy or renewable energy, in automobile transportation or in multimodal, consumer-focused minimal vehicle transportation. That's where we choose to focus on water-intensive technologies or water-efficient technologies. This is what, that's where the money gets put on the table to pay for the choices that we make. And as I hinted at before, it's a place where the logic is distorted because we can't see, the economic tools we have, the finance tools we have, don't have a good view of physical reality. They don't measure what are called externalities. They're oriented to short-term effects, not long-term effects. And a number of other factors that impede our ability to make intelligent decisions. So it seems to me there's enormous leverage there. One of the lessons I learned from Bucky Fuller, sort of primary mentor for me, was the notion of trim tab, which he talked about, identified himself as a trim tab. If you think about a giant supertanker, football field long, has a huge rudder at the back of it that steers the ship. The rudder is so big that the force required to push it through the water to change its angle exceeds the ability of our hydraulic systems to push that big hunk of metal that far. So what the nautical engineers developed is a little rudder on the back of the rudder called the trim tab. The hydraulics move the little rudder. The little rudder moves the big rudder. The big rudder moves the ship. Bucky said, call me trim tab. The lesson for me was to look for where are those places, where are the places that a strategically focused small effort could start to move bigger rudders that can then move the big ship. And I think some of those live in the realm of finance.
Absolutely. And I was recently up at the group called Ceres, run by our friend Mindy Luber, which has been working on helping lots of companies become more sustainable, and she also came to the conclusion that it was vital to be working in the area of finance. Are you connecting in with Ceres at all?
We're connecting in with a lot of organizations. We're taking a distinctive approach. This is not going to be as much a policy or lobbying as an educational approach. We're going to build product. We're going to build financial products, financial instruments that encompass the kind of thinking that you and I have been speaking about and that put them into vehicles that people can invest in.
So when you say building a financial product, what are you thinking of?
Think about a variety of investment funds. I'm not going to get into detail on what they are. We're not quite ready to talk about them in specifics. But think about the gamut of everything from exchange-traded funds to private equity funds and everything in between. Think about vehicles that enable people like you or me to invest our money in things that are more in line with our values and that help build the future that we want. Now, there's a lot of this already going on. There's, $15 trillion of assets under some form of socially responsible management or ESG, environmental, social, and governance-focused management. But a lot of that activity has flawed assumption in it. A lot of these funds accept market matching or what they call concessionary returns, slightly lower financial returns in exchange for the heartwarming value of doing the right thing. And our premise is very different. Our premise is that doing the right thing should be able to outperform the market, not match the market, not do a little bit less, but outperform. And so everything that we're building is focused on that. And the reason that we're saying that is that in our experience of the last 30-some-odd years of working with companies large and small, it's very clear to us from the data that there's no necessary conflict between making money and making sense. In fact, you can do both, and that's where we'll be focusing.
Right, absolutely. Well, I hope you get up and running soon, because there's a lot of people who have just lost, like, hundreds of billions of dollars there in the market over this past year, and they're looking for a place to go. So, and I agree with you. If you just look at things like moving towards zero waste, well, there should be no such thing as waste. You know, why should we be putting energy or water or any other resource, as a waste? That's actually a resource. It just needs to be put in the right context to turn a so-called waste into a resource.
Well, you're exactly right. And if you look at the model of living systems, which is what I do through all my work, there is no waste in living systems, or no persistent accumulated waste. Certainly, no accumulating toxic waste. There, the waste product of one organism is the food of the next organism. The droppings of the deer in the meadow become part of the soil fertility that generates the plants that the deer eats. And you have a cyclical process rather than a linear process. And so the whole notion of a cyclical, of a circular economy is one of the big power points in this work today. Been going on around the world in many forms, ranging from recycling to zero waste strategies to what now the Ellen MacArthur Foundation out of Britain has dubbed the circular economy. There's enormous economic value to be realized there. There's a mind shift that lives at the core of this, as with so many of the issues that we're discussing. People take it for granted that there's always going to be waste. If I'm manufacturing, clothing, there's always going to be trim as I cut out fabric to a pattern to make a set of blue jeans, there's going to be trim. And maybe that goes to landfill, or maybe in a better model it goes, gets shredded up and put into building insulation, which is great. But, the very notion of calling it waste itself distorts the picture. My friend David Rejeski, used to be at the U.S. Department of Energy, used the term non-product output. And it's a bit of a clunky term, but what he was trying to say is that this stuff is stuff that you've made that you can't sell. Now, if you're in business to make money, why would you spend plant and equipment and raw materials and energy and water and labor and management to produce stuff that you can't sell? And if you'll allow me just a silly indulgence, imagine that Levi Strauss is, making blue jeans in a factory somewhere. They're being loaded on a truck at the end of the day to be taken to market. The truck pulls out from the factory and someone forgot to close the back gate on the truck. And as it pulls out, blue jeans just fall out over the highway. Well, everybody knows that that's a stupid way to do a business. It's just completely obvious. No one would even think of doing it that way. But somehow we sort of tolerate this production of non-product in the system otherwise. And, part of it is that it's not visible to people in striking terms. If you look at the mass of all the stuff that's produced in the United States, what percentage of it would you think is product, and what percentage of it would you think is non-product?
Of things that come out of factories in the U.S.?
The physical stuff that we make versus the physical stuff that goes to landfills or up smokestacks or down sewer pipes.
I'm guessing it's probably half product, half waste?
20% product.
Wow.
80% non-product. In one of the most advanced economies the world has ever seen. If you take the 20% that is product and track that over the next 6 months, this according to Paul Hawken, 80% of that is gone at the end of 6 months. So, net, you've got about 6% durable value being produced by this great economy. Could we do better than that? I think so. Can we do better than that profitably? I'm quite clear that we can, and that's part of the job here is to peel back the blindness. Let us see what's really going on. Let us see the opportunities we have to do better in alignment with the things that we really care about.
All right. Well, there's so many possibilities out there, and you've been great throughout your career identifying and moving and showing what can be done in both business and government. Unfortunately, a lot of the people who are in charge of both companies and government are not as enlightened or informed as you are, and we're kind of in a pickle right now. If you look, you know, looking at an overview of where we stand, particularly with the climate change problem, kind of what do you see as the overview in the sustainability revolution? How far along are we? How much more time do we have before the climate change problems kind of overwhelm us with all the wildfires and hurricanes and floods? So what's your big picture view of where we're at right now?
We're at a very dangerous and exciting point.
Mm-hmm.
I hesitate to go to the old, the old Charles Dickens best of times, worst of times, but there we are. We're facing a climate crisis, the scale and significance of which most people don't understand. This is not just a matter of inconvenience, but massive disruption.
Mm-hmm.
Economy, ecosystems, community, and so forth around the world, possibly sooner than we would expect. The projections ratchet up and ratchet up each year. Here in the San Francisco Bay Area, we're, the normative projections say that the San Francisco Bay will rise 3 to 6 feet by the end of the century. 3 to 6 feet, which means that, if you think about freeways, airports, infrastructure, hospitals, there's going to have to be hundreds of billions of dollars of investment that no one had budgeted in order to protect us from the changes of those things. There's going to be, if you think about low-lying regions of the world, Bangladesh comes first to mind, you're going to see massive movements of refugees, which has political disruptive factors and so forth. And we could go on with the bad news. Droughts,
right.
Fires, vulnerabilities of all sorts. That is looming before us. Unless we get this thing under control, and we are behind target on every major measure on how we're doing that. At the same time, we're seeing an explosion of innovation in national governments, local governments, corporations around the world. We see things ranging from, the UN Climate Initiative itself, every country in the world that has signed on to the U.S. climate to the UN climate goals. You have growing numbers of cities that are setting goals of 100% renewable energy. You have the Renewable Energy Buyers Network of, I lost count of how many corporations have committed to move themselves to renewable energy. You see the countries, Norway, India, Great Britain, and others that have said only electric vehicles after a certain point in time, targets as soon as 2025 or 2030. You see, I mentioned before, the $15 trillion or so of investment management that has been shifting in this direction. So at the same time as the doom and gloom, there's this thrilling ferment and creativity that's underway. Mm-hmm. Governor Brown held a global climate action summit in San Francisco in September, had, I think, 5,000 people from around the world, the front edge of climate activists and electeds and so forth. And at one of the opening sessions in San Francisco City Hall, 30 different mayors from around the world talked about their climate initiatives of their cities. And frankly, Eleanor, it was thrilling. And you and I have both been around politics long enough to know that you can put an elected up in front of a microphone and hand them a speech. They'll do a good job of speaking the speech.
Mm-hmm.
And sounding like it's real. But there was a sense here that, at least for me, that these mayors deeply cared about what they were saying and actually knew what they were talking about. It wasn't just a speech they were reading, but something they were well-briefed on and well-grounded in and very committed to. So there's the landscape. You said a pickle. I think that's too kind a word. We're in a very dangerous situation in human history.
Right.
And we have incredible opportunities to make something of this. That can shift that history and make us proud. Which do we choose? Don't know. Which is going to win? Don't know. All I know is that my work and the work of the people that I'm involved with is focused on how do we do a good job of that? How do we guide this society as much as we can to the better choice?
Well, to paraphrase a well-known quote, we're kind of in a very exciting race now between sustainability and oblivion. And I appreciate the incredible work you've done with business and with Palo Alto and now through that, you know, many other cities, I'm sure, to do amazing work and help to show the way. What do you see as the most compelling opportunities right now? Like, what do you think we should be focusing on and doing right now?
Who's we?
Citizens of the United States.
Pay attention. Talk about what you really care about. Look for ways to line your personal choices and your behavior and your economic choices with what you care about as much as you can. That means not just voting for candidates that support the future that you want. It means recognizing that you vote every day, every time you slap a dollar on the counter in a store or give your credit card to, you know, to an e-commerce site. We are voting for a future every time we move money. So I think for each of us individually, it's to get those into alignment as best we can. I say as best we can because it's imperfect. We have, you know, we have the choices that we have. You know, it's hard to live like a saint. But if we can each pay attention and do incrementally better and better each day, I think that's where you start.
Right. And we're excited now because we just got so many new members of Congress elected, and today they got sworn in. We now have the Democrats taking over the House under the leadership of Speaker Pelosi's return to power from your neck of the woods there.
Yes, and we're very proud of that. But even for me, even more exciting than that is that we now have the notion of Green New Deal on the table.
That's what I was going to, leading up to ask you, what do you think of this kind of uprising almost spontaneously or somewhere it's coming from, this Green New Deal idea? Because the 2016 election, there was, and even in 2018, there was almost no mention of climate change. But now, boom, the Green New Deal has been coming up, young people organizing and taking over offices in Congress and pushing for a select committee. What do you think of the Green New Deal?
I think it's a compelling idea. It's really capturing people's imaginations. It's got a breadth and a scope to it that is rare in American politics and is impressive. It's not. It's you know, it's striking in that it includes social and economic justice as well as environmental justice in the mix, so I salute them for that. I think, you know, it's missing some pieces, but it doesn't speak very much about regenerative agriculture. It doesn't speak very much about water. But these are things that will come into the mix over the course of the discussions over the next year or two. I think what's most important about it is that it puts it square on the table. And we're seeing more and more political people orienting around that. Washington Governor Jay Inslee just announced as a presidential candidate said he's making climate the centerpiece of his campaign, very much in contrast to, as you said, 2018, 2016. You know, we've seen, maybe we're starting to see a shift among the mediators. The media has not covered the climate issue barely at all over the past several years. This last Sunday, Meet the Press devoted the entire hour. They never do a single-issue show. They didn't devote the entire hour to the climate crisis. Now, some of my friends say, yeah, too little, too late. And I say, maybe so, but there it is. It happened. It's a marker now. It sets the standard now, and I think we're going to see very different consideration of this issue going forward, particularly as the crisis literally heats up. And
right,
the question
exactly.
is whether we can get ahead of the crisis. And, you know, Winston Churchill once said you could count on the Americans to really come through after they've exhausted every possibility. And
yes.
I'm hoping that we can make the right moves before we exhaust all possibilities of not.
Absolutely. Doing. And we have another election coming up next year in 2020. We've got a lot of good candidates running. If you were advising the incoming president, what are the top three things you think the president should do regarding this question of climate change and sustainability?
Put a price on carbon,
mm-hmm.
number one. Number two, identify and eliminate all environmentally destructive subsidies, or more broadly, the subsidies that don't further the world that we want. And this is going to take some, you know, this will take political battle, but the landscapes shift. In California a few years ago, we had a statewide referendum Prop 23 that was proposing to roll back California's world's leading climate policies. It was largely funded by out-of-state oil interests, but that's happened before. What was notable about it, and we did win, by the way, we beat this challenge back, but was notable was that the political landscape, which had previously mostly been around environmental issues, had mostly been business on one side and environmentalists on the other side. In this case, the landscape was most of business and the environmentalists on one side and the fossil fuel industry on the other side. Business split. Hmm. And most of the California business community said, you know, our interests are no longer aligned with the petroleum and coal industries. They are something else. And so the landscape changed dramatically, and I think that portends for what's possible in the future. The third thing I would suggest to the president is as we suggested in Palo Alto, is put a, you know, put a climate question on every memo, executive action, piece of legislation to ask that people identify what are the potential impacts on this issue.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of carbon impact, environmental impact?
Well, we could say just climate for starters. We could say greenhouse mm-hmm. gas emissions. We could say sustainability more broadly. I mean, the challenge here mm-hmm. is that it's a traditional challenge in progressive politics is that we start to build Christmas trees, you know, ornamented with everything we can possibly think of,
right?
And everything that we care about. So these are valid concerns, but at a functional level, you can't do everything at once. You have
right.
to focus, and you have to choose, and you have to look for where is the leverage, where's the trim tab, where a few smaller actions can have rippling effect that touch all the other things that we care about. So that's where I would start.
Fantastic, and that's good advice for all of us. And that's the end of our program. So, Gil Friend, I want to thank you so much for your incredible work helping advance and be a revolutionary for sustainability. Really appreciate all that you've done.
Thank you, Eleanor. It's a complete pleasure being with you.